In the heart of California's Sierra Nevadas, where the night is so quiet you can hear the stars, a small cabin stood as a sanctuary for a single mother and her children. But on April 11, 1981, something or someone slipped through the unlocked door of Cabin 28 in Keddie, California. By dawn, four lives were gone, one vanished without a trace, and a killer melted into the shadows of the pines. Tonight, we unravel the chilling, unsolved mystery of the Keddie Cabin murders. A case so haunting, it whispers through the mountains still. Settle in, dim the lights, and let the darkness tell its tale. Welcome to True Crime Sleep Stories, the podcast where we weave the threads of history's darkest mysteries into a tapestry to guide you toward slumber. I'm your host, Kelly Brink, and in each episode, we delve into the eerie corners of true crime. Cases that linger like fog, unsolved and unsettling, perfect for those who find comfort in the macabre as they drift off. If you enjoy these tales, subscribe and leave a review. It helps keep the shadows alive. Tonight, we're traveling to Keddie, California, a forgotten speck in the Sierras where a brutal quadruple murder in 1981 turned a family's safe haven into a house of horrors. This is the story of Cabin 28, a place where screams went unheard, where children slept through slaughter, and where answers remain buried in the frost. Close your eyes, let your breathing slow, and let the story carry you into the night. This episode of True Crime Sleep Stories contains graphic descriptions of extreme violence and murder, including detailed accounts of a brutal quadruple homicide. The content may be disturbing, particularly due to the horrific nature of the unsolved Keddie Cabin murders. We believe it's important to address the brutality to honor the victims and inspire justice. But please listen with care and prioritize your well-being. Picture a place where the world feels untouched. Rolling hills cloaked in pine and fir. The air sharp with the scent of sap. And a sky so vast it swallows your worries. That's Keddie, California, in 1980. A tiny settlement in Plumas County nestled 250 miles northeast of Sacramento along Highway 70. Once a bustling railroad hub, by the late 1970s, Keddie was fading, a cluster of weathered cabins around a crumbling resort, its glory days lost to time. The population barely scraped 100, a mix of retirees, drifters, and families chasing cheap rent in a town where everyone knew your name and secrets traveled faster than the wind. Into this quiet decay stepped Glenna Susan Sharp, Sue to all who knew her. At 36, Sue was a survivor, a single mother of five who'd weathered a rough divorce from her husband Jim and a hardscrabble life in a Connecticut trailer. Born March 29, 1945, in rural Washington, Sue had a warmth that drew people in, but a guarded edge honed by years of struggle. With her dark hair and quick smile, she worked long shifts as a waitress, her hands calloused, but her spirit unbroken. In fall 1980, she loaded her kids, Sheila, 14, John, 15, Tina, 12, Rick, 10, and Greg, 5, into a battered Chevy Nova and headed west, chasing a fresh start. Cabin 28 at the Keddie Resort was their landing spot. For $200 a month, it was a steal. A two-story A-frame with creaky floors, mismatched wallpaper, and a front porch overlooking a dirt path to Spanish Creek. The ground floor held a living room, kitchen, and Sue's bedroom. Upstairs, a loft for Tina and the younger boys. Downstairs, a basement rec room where John claimed his space. It wasn't much. Drafts snuck through the walls and the heater sputtered, but to Sue, it was a canvas for hope. She envisioned family dinners, kids playing in the woods, a life stitched together with love. The Sharps settled in fast. Sheila, poised and studious, joined the drama club at Quincy High. John, tall and charismatic with a mop of brown hair, played baseball and painted houses for cash. His best friend, Dana Wingate, 17, often at his side. Dana, a lanky Quincy kid with a rap sheet for petty theft, crashed in the basement, dreaming of freedom with John. Tina, quiet and doe-eyed, stuck close to Sue, reading in the loft or trailing her to the grocery store. Rick and Greg were the wild ones building forts and dodging chores. Sue waitressed at the backdoor bar in Quincy, 10 miles away, serving lagers and swapping gossip with coworker Marilyn Smart, who lived across the path in cabin 26 with her volatile husband, Marty, and their son, Justin, 5. Keddie's small-town pulse beat steady but tense. Neighbors like the Seabolts in cabin 27, Don, Ellen, and their daughter, Paula, Sheila's best friend, were tight-knit. But whispers of trouble lingered. Marty Smart's drunken rages, drug deals along the railroad tracks, transients passing through. Sue kept her kids close, locking the door at night, though in Keddie, locks were more habit than necessity. By April 1981, spring bloomed. Wildflowers dotted the hills, and the Sharps felt rooted. But something was watching, waiting, in the shadows of the pines. April 11th, 1981, was a Saturday like any other. Clear, mid-60s, the kind of day that begged for open windows. Sue worked the lunch shift at the back door, laughing with Marilyn over spilled beers. By 11:30 a.m., she was back, running errands with Sheila and Greg. At the canyon's edge, they spotted John and Dana hitchhiking, windswept, grinning, fresh from a morning of teenage trouble in Quincy. Sue scooped them up, dropping them at cabin 28 by 1:30 p.m. "Be home by dark," she warned John, who nodded, already plotting a night out. The afternoon unspooled lazily. Rick and Greg kicked a soccer ball in the yard. Tina watched TV at the Seabolts until 10 p.m., then scampered home in her pajamas. Sheila headed to Paula's for a sleepover, her overnight bag slung over her shoulder. John and Dana hitched back to Quincy for a party, seen at the mini mart around 8 p.m., buying Cokes and chatting up girls. By 10:15 p.m., they were back at cabin 28, crashing in the basement, their laughter muffled by the TV, the love boat droning in the living room where Sue lounged with a coffee. Justin Smart, the neighbor kid, had wandered over after dinner, joining Rick and Greg on the couch. The boys dozed off, lulled by the TV's glow and the warmth of the cabin. Tina kissed Sue goodnight and climbed to the loft. By 11 p.m., the house was still. Crickets outside, the creek's murmur faint through the pines. Sue, in her nightgown, flipped off the kitchen light, ready for bed. Then, sometime between 11:30 p.m. and 1 a.m., the night turned predator. The front door clicked open, no forced entry, no splintered wood. Two figures, maybe more, moved inside, their steps deliberate. They carried weapons from the cabin itself, a butcher knife from the counter, a claw hammer from a drawer, electrical cords yanked from lamps and the phone. The attack was swift, brutal, and eerily contained. Sue was first. She fought, scratches on her arms, a gash across her palm, but the hammer cracked her skull. The knife plunged into her chest, 11 wounds tearing through her 5'5" frame. She collapsed near the couch, blood pooling on the linoleum. John, roused by the commotion, charged upstairs from the basement, barefoot, jeans unzipped. A cord looped his neck, strangling him as hammer blows fractured his temple. He fell face down near his mother, his fight over. Dana Wingate, lanky and fierce, was last. He swung, maybe with a lamp, but the intruders overpowered him. Cords crushed his windpipe. The hammer pulverized his face. Over 30 wounds, skull shattered, nose broken, teeth loosened in a frenzy of rage. He slumped against the wall, cords dangling like nooses. The living room became a slaughterhouse. Blood arced on walls, soaked the rug, smeared the furniture. Yet the violence stayed confined. No splatter in the hall, no screams loud enough to wake the boys. Rick, Greg, and Justin slept in the back bedroom, inches from the carnage, their breathing soft under blankets. Justin later claimed glimpses, shadows, a woman's cry, the thud of metal, but fear or shock kept him silent. Tina was the anomaly. 12 years old, slight and shy, she vanished. No body in the cabin, no blood trail to the door. Her bed in the loft was empty, pajamas gone. Taken alive, killed elsewhere. The killers left no clue, slipping out as silently as they'd come. Back door, front, or into the woods. The TV hummed on, the only witness to the horror. By 2 a.m., Cabin 28 was a tomb. Dawn broke on April 12, 1981, with church bells ringing in Quincy, 10 miles away. Sheila Sharp, 14, stirred in Paula Siebold's guest bed at Cabin 27. She'd spent the night giggling over TV shows, her mind far from home. Around 7:45 a.m., she crossed the dirt path to Cabin 28 to change for church. The door was unlocked. She pushed it open, calling, "Mom? Johnny?" The scene stopped her cold. Sue lay near the couch, eyes vacant, blood crusted around her. John sprawled nearby, his face a mask of bruises. Dana, twisted against the wall, looked barely human. Blood everywhere. On the floor, the walls, the cushions. Sheila's scream tore through the morning, bringing her to her knees. She stumbled back to the Siebolts, gasping, "Mom's dead! They're all dead!" Ellen Siebold rushed over, confirming the nightmare. Don Siebold dialed 911 at 8:02 a.m., his voice shaking. "Multiple homicides at Keddie Resort, Cabin 28. Deputy William Haldeman arrived first, followed by Sergeant Jack Beaumont. They sealed the scene as Rick, Greg, and Justin emerged from the back bedroom, pale, trembling, unharmed, but hollow-eyed. Rick mumbled, "I heard thumps last night. Thought it was nothing." Justin, clutching Ellen's hand, whispered about bad men. Sheriff Doug Thomas, who'd once lived in Cabin 28, took charge. Crime scene techs from Sacramento descended. Photographs snapped, fingerprints dusted, cords and knives bagged. Autopsies later that day at Quincy Community Hospital pinned time of death between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m. Causes: blunt force trauma for Sue and John, strangulation and beating for Dana. Tina was officially missing, her face soon plastered on posters. 12 years old, 4 feet 11 inches, 78 pounds, brown hair, last seen at 10 p.m. The town reeled. Keddie's dirt roads filled with news vans, locals locked doors for the first time in years. Sue's siblings, Don Davis in California, Stella in Washington, arrived, devastated. "Who'd hurt Sue?" Don asked reporters. "She was just trying to live." Sheila, Rick, and Greg were whisked to foster care. Justin returned to his parents, Marty and Marilyn Smart, in cabin 26. The cabin stood sealed, a silent crime scene as whispers of suspects began to spread. Plumas County Sheriff's Office, with just 3 deputies in 1981, was out of its depth. Sheriff Thomas delegated to investigator Dave Grogan and DA aide Bill Shipp, but the crime scene was a mess from the start. Neighbors trampled the yard before tape went up. Evidence bags sat in an unair-conditioned shed. 2 knives, one a 6-inch butcher, one a paring blade, were recovered, both from the kitchen. A claw hammer, blue-handled, matched skull wounds, but bore no prints. A second hammer, per Justin, was missing. Cords, lamp, phone, stereo were knotted in figure eights, fibers clinging to them. Interviews were chaotic. Sheila, in shock, remembered nothing. Rick heard banging around midnight, but stayed in bed. Justin's story shifted. First, 2 intruders, tall, dark-haired, short, blonde, dragging Tina out the back. Under hypnosis in June 1981, he pointed to his stepfather, Marty Smart. "It was Marty. He had the hammer, hit the lady, took Tina." The session conducted by a local therapist was later deemed unreliable by the DA. Marty Smart became the prime suspect. On April 15th, Grogan and Shipp questioned him at cabin 26. Marty, 36, a Vietnam vet with a rap sheet for domestic violence, claimed he was at the back door bar until 2 a.m. with his friend Richard Bo Bubede, a 43-year-old drifter with Chicago mob ties. Marilyn, his wife, contradicted him. Marty came home at 12:30 a.m., hands bloody, said it was from a truck repair. She found a bloodied knife in the sink, tossed it. Justin, tearful, backed her. "Marty did it. I saw blood on his boots." Marty's past was a minefield. PTSD, bar fights, a 1979 arrest for threatening Marilyn with a rifle. He'd clashed with Sue, jealous of her bond with Marilyn, rumors of a fling swirling. Days after the murders, he burned a pickup truck in his yard, destroying evidence. In May, he told a Reno VA counselor, "I killed the woman and her daughter, but not the boys." The confession was dismissed as hearsay. Bubede, with his own shady history, backed Marty's alibi but failed a polygraph on scene presence. Marty failed on weapon questions. No charges. Evidence was too thin. Other leads collapsed. A drifter, Loren Epley, had a hammer in his truck, cleared by alibi. John and Dana's weed deals pointed to Quincy lowlifes, but no hits. A composite sketch from Justin's first story, tall man, mustache, went nowhere. By July, Sheriff Thomas resigned for a DOJ job, leaving the case to stagnate. Files vanished, photos degraded, Tina's posters faded on telephone poles. Cabin 28 stood empty, a ghost house, until its demolition in 2004. Tina Sharp's absence was the case's darkest riddle. Was she taken alive? A trophy for the killer? killed elsewhere, her body hidden? Searches combed the Sierras, creeks, mines, forests, but found nothing. Then, on April 12, 1984, a bottle hunter in Butte County, 100 miles south near Feather Falls, stumbled on a child's skull in a ravine. Vertebrae and a jawbone followed. An anonymous tip to Butte Sheriff's Office, voice raspy, male, said, "Check Keddy. It's the girl." The tape, undocumented then, surfaced in 2013. They never found her. Camp 18. Dental records confirmed it. Tina, dead roughly 3 years, cause unknown, exposure, trauma, or worse. Her body's distance suggested a second crime scene, but no clues surfaced. The case slept until 2013 when Plumas Sheriff Greg Hagwood, a Quincy native who knew the Sharps, teamed with Detective Mike Gamberg, a Sacramento vet with a bulldog's tenacity. "This ends now," Hagwood vowed. They re-interviewed witnesses. Marilyn, remarried by now, admitted Marty lied about his alibi. Justin, now 37, stood firm. "It was Marty. I saw the blood." In 2016, a pond near Cabin 28 yielded the missing hammer. Blood traces matched the victims. A 2018 DNA test on the handle gave a partial male profile. Not Marty's, but local. In 2021, a tip line lit up. A dying man's confession, unverified. Gamberg chases it still. Sheila Sharp, now a mother in Oregon, pushes for justice, for mom, for Tina. Rick and Greg, scarred but private, support from afar. Marty, 80, lives in Reno. The cabin site is a grassy lot, a plaque proposed but never built. Pluma's tip line, 530-283-6360, waits for the call that breaks it open. And so, the Pines of Keddy keep their secrets. Whispering of a night when laughter turned to screams, and a family's dream became a nightmare. The Keddy Cabin murders remain unsolved, a wound in the Sierra's heart. Sue, John, Dana, and Tina lost to a shadow that slipped through an unlocked door. Was it rage, revenge, or something darker? The answers lie buried, perhaps in the words of a dying man or the silt of a forgotten pond. For now, Cabin 28 is gone, but its echoes linger. Thank you for joining us for this episode of True Crime Sleep Stories. If this tale stirred you, share it with a friend or leave a review. It keeps our fire burning. Have a tip? Call Plumas County Sheriff at 530-283-6360. Next time, we drift to another unsolved shadow. Until then, sleep softly, dream safely, and lock your doors. Good night.